ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
G'day, Angus Furley here in the Country Hour chair for Warwick Long again today. Coming up on the Country Hour very soon, I'll be joined by Federal Nationals leader David Littleproud to talk about some of the big issues in agri-politics at the moment. If you've got any questions you'd like me to put to him, you can get them in quick smart on the text line 0467 842 722. And in the second half of the show, we'll be checking in on the parliamentary inquiry into pig welfare that started in Melbourne this morning. Reminder, the text line 0467 842 722. First up today, though, a fruit grower who you may have heard in the news has spoken out about the emotional and physical toll ripping out his apple trees has had on his family as the latest Senate hearing into supermarket behaviour continues today. Tempers have flared at times at the inquiry into Coles and Woolworths' dealings with producers. Tim Fuchs reports.
James McClymont was a fourth-generation orchardist near Orange, but after facing decades of falling profits, he decided to bulldoze his 22,000 trees. He now runs cattle on his property and has spoken about the impact of having to pull out his trees.
I used to pull up at the first tree in a block of apples, and I'd sit there for a few minutes, I did think about it, because they were your production, they were your life. So you slowly doze the first tree out. Once you got the first tree gone, you'd be right, you just go and do the whole block. But it wasn't easy, I'll tell you.
Another orchardist, Guy Gaeta, has told the hearing he decided years ago to stop selling to the supermarkets due to concerns over prices offered to producers and the constant rejection of his fruit. He urged the politicians to expose the supermarkets for their practices.
Don't get conned by them. And you people can put the brakes on this. Our grandkids are growing up. They're going to be families and that. And we won't be around, but... yeah, we didn't leave them a good world, you know. We got to expose them for what they are. And when they reject something, there's got to be something wrong. And I don't know any farmer that would deliberately put stuff in the boxes to get rejected. Mm. It's crazy. No. That's a no-brainer. They all worry about getting through. We're just over slaughter.
The New South Wales Farmers Association wants the ACCC to have more powers to investigate the relationship between supermarkets and the farmer. The association's John Lowe told the committee that the way it stands now, if farmers don't do what the supermarkets want, they can then be blacklisted.
At the moment, we've got a producer network in all fields that are seriously intimidated by the market power of the majors. Then if you complain, where do you go? And it's so easy to just go on the I don't want to buy from you list because you're trouble. And that can happen in any produce, and all of a sudden your orders can quietly diminish, or you can't get a contract to supply product because you're trouble. So it's very insidious, it's can be very subtle, but the result is that you get taught fairly strongly and people and others will see what's happened to you and they'll keep their heads down.
Riverina citrus grower Joanna Brighenti is chair of the Farmer Association's Horticultural Committee.
Year after year, seeing the different effects, and you've got all the weather effects that come with it and the pests and disease and all those things, and you're constantly out there trying to manage, you know, those things. It's very difficult. And when you're not seeing a return on your investment, the mental health... you know, it's really disheartening, and people are just, like I said, people are just walking away. They're not reinvesting in, you know, they're not leaving the farms to the kids. You've seen, you know, orchards being bulldozed. I think 15% of the pear orchards were pulled out in the last 12 months. 15%. That's alarming for our food security. You know, we're going to be relying on imports. This is crazy. We have the water, we have the land, we have amazing irrigation areas set up for these, for our produce. And, you know, we're not getting a return as a government on our investment there, because we're not allowing our farmers to make money because we're sitting here under duopolies that are taking all the fat out of the system.
There was a fair bit of emotion in today's hearing, both inside and outside, and it spilled over during the morning break when Independent MP Bob Catter tried to hold a press conference with two people dressed up in pig outfits. He was challenged by National Senator for New South Wales, Ross Cadell, who is a member of the inquiry.
Why don't you spend a little bit of time attacking Woolworths and
what
Coles
do you think we're doing
instead
here?
Of playing politics?
Not you. I've got a problem with you, Bob. I've got a problem with the stuntman here.
Mate, I'm warning you,
He thought he knew better than
useless,
people to
learn. Useless. This bloke won't shut up. He won't let anyone else have a say. And I can understand why he won't let anyone else.
You're telling me on taxpayer money to put
Don't keep interrupting me. Do you hear me? Don't keep interrupting me. Right, now shut up and let me have a go.
After the dust-up, the hearing continued with Cattle Australia asking politicians for more transparency in the supermarket sector to ensure beef producers are getting good value for the product they sell.
That was Tim Fookes with that report from that Senate inquiry into supermarket pricings, that today's hearing being held in Orange. Well, the supermarket pricing inquiry, energy generation and transmission lines, animal welfare, ag visas, vehicle efficiency standards, there are clearly lots of big issues in the world of agri-politics at the moment. Joining me now to discuss some of them is Federal Nationals leader David Littleproud, who is in Victoria this week. Thanks for joining the Country Hour.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
David Littleproud, we just heard from a range of food producers about their dealings with the big supermarkets. You're in Victoria. I understand you'll be meeting with farmers to hear their stories. What sorts of things do you expect to hear?
Well, it's a common theme, and the supermarkets over some time have not been dealing in a transparent and fair way with farmers, and that's also translated through to not dealing fairly with consumers. And now, I'm not about stunts. I'm not about getting dressed up in pig suits. The Nationals have made it very clear. In fact, one of the policy settings that we came out with straight after the election was around holding these supermarkets account, who hold 74% of the grocery market. In the UK and the US, the big three competitors there control about 30 to 40% of the market. So we have a lack of competition, and so they become the market. And what we're saying is we don't want to fix prices. What we want is fair, transparent prices from the farm gate to Australians' plates. Now, that's not happening. And so while there isn't competition, until we get competition into the market, the Nationals have put together a policy document that includes divestiture powers. So what that means is that it would give the ACCC powers to strip these supermarkets in a geographical area of some of their stores and force them to sell them to smaller competitors, to independents, and or include them divesting of some of their chains like Big W or BWS. So there's a real punitive penalty there that is a big stick to make sure that consumers are dealt with properly, but so too are farmers. And that's what I'm garnering support in Canberra on. And we think this is a sensible way, so much so that Alan Feltz, the former ACCC chair, has basically came out in his report a couple of months ago backing what the Nationals are asking for. So in the coming couple of weeks, we're working with our coalition partners for them to understand this. We had an ACCC perishable goods inquiry when we were in government, and we implemented much of those recommendations. The ACCC at that point didn't want divestiture powers, but I think we've now got evidence to demonstrate they are required, and I think that we're getting to a point where the Liberals understand that as well. Peter Dutton's understanding that as well, and that we want to go back to Parliament at some point with a real solution that can bring the Parliament together. But sadly, the Labor government's just said, we don't think we should have divestiture powers because they're very rarely used in this world. In fact, that'd be a bit like Stalin estates. Well, that's the whole idea of having punitive penalties. You don't actually want to use them unless you have to, whether that be criminal or whether that be civil like this, and because they're a deterrent. That's the whole idea of it. But we already had divestiture powers in this country. We brought in big stick legislation for the power companies that would force them to divest of some of their power stations if they were going to close them down too soon. So this isn't something something new to Australia. We've already got them. We'd rather the government do it with us. And I actually asked them 12 months ago and made it very clear to them that the Nationals would give them support if they wanted to finish off those reforms we started in government. But unfortunately, the Labor government's walked away from it. I think that's a missed opportunity in a cost of living crisis. And when farmers are making real decisions, that we can get fair, transparent prices. Australians deserve that. But unfortunately, we've got a government that doesn't see it that way.
So divestiture, would that be coalition policy that you would take to the next election?
Well, that's what we're giving the opportunity for the for our coalition partners to understand, and the, and we're designing that to make sure that that is a realistic solution that we can take to give comfort not just to producers but also to consumers. And this is the thing, is that we're not asking for fixed prices. We're just asking for fair, transparent prices. And I think competition policy needs to be also more intricate than that, so not just divestiture powers, but also being able to bring in mechanisms that give that transparency in cost of production. And we started some of that work with over $6 million invested in industry to be able to achieve that. But I think technology will also provide the opportunity for us to demonstrate that and to give consumer confidence and give farmer confidence around a marketplace that is fair and transparent. So there's a suite of measures, and I think that's what we will be taking and working through now, and I hope in the coming couple of weeks that we'll be able to demonstrate that. And still would rather us do this collectively as a parliament across party lines than just the Nationals having to lead it, because I think we need reform now. We've talked about it for a long time. We don't need more inquiries. The evidence is clear. We don't need to keep reviewing it. We just need to do it.
Let's move on, because we have got a lot to cover. You're in Victoria, where transmission lines and the transmission of renewable energy is a real hot button issue at the moment, with farmers right throughout Western Victoria opposed to plans to build transmission lines across their farms. You're saying, as part of a solution to that angst, you're backing in nuclear. But there are lots of opponents to it. They say that it would take too long to build it. It would cost far too much. What would you say to those criticisms?
Well, let's let the market decide. Take away the ban and let the capital flow in an equitable way between renewables and nuclear, but also put in place safeguards, not just for nuclear, but also for renewables. They have lost their social license. We are actually destroying the very thing that they're there to protect, the natural environment. We're tearing up native vegetation. We're tearing up prime agricultural land, stripping away our food security. When we've got time, and we don't need to do this. What we're experiencing at the moment is Labor trying to get to net zero by 2030, rather than understanding our only international commitment is at 2050. And we've got sovereignty of all our resources. Why wouldn't we look to transition our coal-fired power stations to nuclear power plants? That means you don't need the 28,000 kilometres of extra transmission lines that Labor, while say is more expensive to run nuclear, they haven't in any of their costings added in the nearly $100 billion to put up these transmission lines. And look what happened in this state a couple of months ago, when a big storm came through and knocked down your transmission lines. If you add 28,000 kilometres of transmission lines, you increase the risk of that happening again. With increased storms and weather events, you actually make your energy system more vulnerable. But I'm not an educated man. I didn't get to get a university degree. But in grade 8 business economics, I learned about this thing called concentration risk. And what we are doing by putting all our energy eggs in one basket is actually making our energy grid more vulnerable, because we haven't spread our risk across coal and gas with carbon capture storage, nuclear, and renewables. But there's a place for renewables, and particularly if you want to look at solar panels, we'll put them on an environment they can't destroy.
With
and that's
nuclear,
on people's
though,
rooftops.
With nuclear, though, is it ever going to be socially acceptable?
Yes, we're going to need a nuclear industry because we're going to have nuclear submarines. In fact, Australian scientists are the ones that have solved the problem in terms of waste. Synroc is an Australian invention that actually that transforms this into a synthetic rock that's stable, and we have led the world in this. We already have a nuclear industry in this country. It's called Lucas Heights. And in fact, less than a kilometre from Lucas Heights, houses are selling for $1.5 million. So I don't think the people of Lucas Heights have been too worried about a nuclear reactor being close to them. So this is about our culture in this country changing from a culture of why can't we do things to how can we. And having that culture change about backing ourselves with the technology and the know-how that we have here. And many of those coal-fired power jobs can transition to nuclear jobs. And you don't need the transmission lines because you're plugging it in where existing infrastructure is. That's common sense. And we've got time to achieve this. Everyone thinks we've got to achieve this by 2030. We don't. We've got time and we can do this sensibly. We can do it in a uniquely Australian way. I've got the courage of conviction to be proven wrong. I might be wrong about nuclear, but let the market decide. Chris Bowen, Anthony Albanese doesn't have that conviction and courage, but I think we should open up that ban, let the market decide and see where the capital flows. I've already had conversations with met coal producers in central Queensland who would build their own small-scale modular nuclear plant because they ran their mine off it. They would get a 14% premium for their coal that they export out of this country. They'd pay for it themselves.
On a related issue, the Federal Labor Party is pushing new vehicle efficiency standards that would come into effect next year and place a cap on emissions for new vehicles. Farm groups say they're worried this would push up the price of utes, for example. I know the NFF has called for primary production to be exempt from the standards. Do you support that?
Well, I expect everything to be exempt until such time as you give time for manufacturers to achieve the technology changes that they need to meet these emission standards. What's happened is this government has simply brought that forward to the 1st of January next year, rather than allowing time for the manufacturers to bring in and adopt technology and create and develop that technology to a commercial standard, and not appreciating that we are a very small marketplace in the world and we are right-hand drive. So that limits us even further. And so this is about, again, understanding what Chris Bowen's trying to all achieve by 2030 can be done over a lot longer period where technology is allowed to catch up to what his ideology is, and we'll still get the same outcomes without the tax being imposed. Because just understand, the manufacturers and dealers aren't going to wear that this tax. And for every gram over the emission standard, they pay $100. Now that's going to be passed on to you. One manufacturer alone will be costing about an extra $320 million a year. That's something they're going to have to pass on to us. And this isn't just farmers and tradies. This is young families. Young families where they need SUVs as tools of trade to put the pram and the groceries in the back and car seats for the kids. This is everyone's going to pay this. When you don't need to. If we take our time, we use some common sense, you can get solutions where technology and the manufacturers will deal for this and they'll create it. But if they're not given time, someone has to pay, and that's us.
Let's move on to the ag visa. That was former coalition policy and then it was scrapped by the current federal government. But by a technicality, I suppose, there was an agreement signed with the Vietnamese government. So there will be up to 1,000 workers coming in from Vietnam, but not from all of those other Southeast Asian countries that were initially proposed to be part of the scheme. The Labor government saying that the PALM scheme, the Pacific, sourcing workers from the Pacific, is enough. But why not have both? Why not have PALM and also have workers coming in from Southeast Asia?
Well, when the National Party are part of the next coalition government, you will. The ag visa will be reinstated. In fact, the Labor government has already rejected offers from other ASEAN countries to sign up to the ag visa. They rejected that. And what they've also done is changed the Pacific worker scheme to be unviable for many, many producers, particularly horticulturists, because they've taken away the averaging provision, which means that farmers for fruit pickers have got to pay them a minimum 30-hour week, regardless of whether they're lying on the couch doing nothing because of weather or not. And what we had before was a common sense solution where you could average that out over the season. But instead, producers are saying they can't use the Pacific scheme. But beyond that, again, is the NFF and COSBOA at the Jobs and Skills Summit said that we needed 172,000 extra workers to get food from a paddock to Australians' plates. And the Pacific scheme at best could only bring in 42,000. So there's a big shortage, and when you look through the entire supply chain, much of it's only working at 60-odd percent capacity because we don't have the physical workers. So the Nationals have made it very clear. We will have an ag visa reinstated. We'll look to work through a more workable Pacific worker scheme so that we give farmers the confidence to plant and know that they can get it off. And we have those markets that are equitable and fair both domestically and internationally. But if we don't do that, then you strip away that confidence. And that's a no-nonsense, non-negotiable promise I make that as the National Party leader, you will have an ag visa and we will fix the Pacific scheme to make sure that it is more workable and equitable so that farmers have that confidence of labour supply.
Just finally, David Littleproud, on the text line, I'm not sure if you're aware, but in Western Victoria, just around the Warracknabeel community, in the space of 3 weeks, three farmers were killed in accidents. A friend of one of those farmers has texted in to say, what can we do to reduce fatalities in agriculture?
Yeah, we've all got a responsibility. This it just demonstrates the fragility of life. And while we take for granted what we do and how we do it sometimes, it's just important we all have a role to play in this. We put money in as a government into safer farms and fair, in a program there, about $3 or $4 million. But this is about making sure we've got proper education, but we all understand we've got a role to play in this, not just governments. You understand we're dealing with heavy machinery and things that can go wrong. And, you know, it's just this is a tragedy that we see any farm death or injury. And everyone is a tragic loss that we need to understand we can do better. Technology will help solve that. Governments can do some of the work, but we all have a role to play. And my heart just goes out to those families who've lost their loved ones in such tragic circumstances.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks for coming on the Country Hour, David Littleproud.
Thanks for having me.
That was David Littleproud there, federal leader of the Nationals, running through some of the big issues in agri-politics at the moment, and then, of course, touching on that string of really sad fatalities around Warracknabeel all in the space of 3 weeks in February. Quite a few people on the text line. This person says, David Littleproud, he was just in government. What did he do? Very little. He is the king of spin. I think there was another text along those lines too. This person says, I will never vote LNP again. The Australian public deserves better. And this person says, amazing how the purity and ease of policy solutions are revealed from the position of opposition. Why couldn't these wise men have seen that when they were in government? Michael says the Littleproud and the Nationals are keeping alive the old country party agrarian socialism of the 1950s. I think that comment harks back to the divestiture position that David Littleproud was taking, saying that's Nationals policy at least to give the ACCC divestiture powers to break up the supermarket duopoly. A few other texts there. This person says, questioning David Littleproud's statement about let the market decide on nuclear. Paul says the market has already decided on renewables. Thanks for all of your texts. A couple more on nuclear as well. This person was criticising David Littleproud's pronunciation of nuclear. Don't think we'll go there. But thanks for all of your texts. 0467 842 722 is the text line.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Let's move on now because a sap-sucking pest is threatening olive oil production across north and central Victoria. Faith Tabaluyan has the story.
Michael Frudenstein has been growing olives in Victoria's Happy Valley for more than 20 years, but he's never seen his olive trees so bare.
This is the first year we've had this attack of this lace bug. Mm-hmm. And it's been quick and extensive.
Mr. Frudenstein is one of several Victorian farmers battling the olive lace bug, a native insect which attacks olive trees, reducing yields and even killing trees if left unaddressed. He says his entire 1,000-tree grove has been affected.
We noticed it earlier on, maybe in November, there was some deterioration of some of the leaves, and I didn't know whether it was a nutrient issue or whether it was something else, but we were going away for 10 days over Christmas, so I sort of left it, and when we came back, the infestation had really increased and started really getting into the trees. There was about 100% that had infestation, but we've saved probably 25% with still quite a lot of leaf matter on the trees, but probably 70 to 75% of the trees have been badly damaged.
But Mr. Freudenstein's experience is far from unique. Tina Knight is the Victorian representative of the Australian Olive Association. She's been fielding calls from concerned farmers across northeast and central Victoria.
I have been, in the last month, rung up numbers of times about people we know and other groves that we don't know, saying that they have this problem and what do they do about it. And so all I can say is that this year, once they hatch and they've got wings, the olive lace bugs can fly, and of course some of the winds we've had, and it's spreading far and wide.
Ms Knight is also working to curb an infestation at her own 27,000 tree grove near Rushworth.
And it was as a result of one of the last phone call that we got about olive lace bugs that we thought, better have a look in our own grove. And yes, we did. We found about four patches of olives that have of the trees that have been affected. But you have to get onto it very quickly and do the appropriate spraying at the appropriate time.
So why the increase in lace bug activity? Chris Pittock is Agriculture Victoria's Manager of Plant Pests and Diseases. He says the spike in infestations is likely due to ideal weather conditions for the pest last year.
We had a pretty mild winter, and we've actually had a pretty kind, as far as a bit of moisture and not too hot, pretty kind lead into summer. So it's actually been pretty good for plants to grow and for insects and other things that like to grow on lush plant growth. It's kind of an ideal time for them. A harsh winter can knock back insect populations, but what we're seeing at the moment is just a little bit of a higher number of insects, good and bad, in the system. So that's just a bit of a seasonal shift, if you like. I think, this is not a typical summer. You know, they're not on the edge of being able to survive. They're actually comfortably being able to find host plants that they can feed off.
Affected growers like Mr. Freudenstein are using chemicals to curb the problem pest. But he says insecticides and labour are driving up his costs.
The pesticide costs $400 and something for 20 litres, and that'll be ongoing if we need any more, but I've still got enough to do another spray. When the arborist comes in, like that's about $3,000 a day, and we're going to take 2 or 3 days to get through that. So that's a serious amount of money that you've got to sell a lot of product to recoup that sort of investment.
Mr. Freudenstein says his olive oil business has already taken a hit.
Our oil production this year will be down probably 75%. So that means we've got to look at how we service our customers that buy oil. We've got restaurants that buy oil in 20-litre drums, and we've got lots of local customers who come and get 3-litre tins or bottles from us as well. So we need to look at that and get some communication going with those customers and say, we may be a bit short going forward.
But Ms Knight says she hopes current olive oil prices will spare growers from even more pain.
Spain is the biggest producer of oil for the world, and they've had two bad years in the last couple of years, and so the actual supply of extra virgin olive oil is very depleted, and so the world price has gone up quite markedly in the last 12 months. So while we might get a reduced crop, hopefully hopefully we can get a really good percentage of oil in our crop, and then it's a good price for the oil.
That was Rushworth olive grower and Australian Olive Association Victorian representative Tina Knight ending that report from Faith Tabaluyan. Very late for rural news, so let's head there now with Emma Field.
G'day, Angus. The New South Wales Farmers Association has told a Senate inquiry the price of fruit and vegetables could drop if supermarkets relax their produce specifications. A federal parliamentary committee is holding a hearing in Orange in the state's central west to hear feedback about the food pricing practices and market power of major retailers. The association's Joanna Brie-Gentney has told the inquiry supermarket rules around how produce look are too strict.
If those parameters were relaxed a bit, you
would be able to supply possibly at a bit of a lower price because you're moving more of your product. You know, you could see the prices would come down a bit in the supermarkets, but at the moment you're not seeing it.
To WA now, where major supply routes into the state are closed due to flooding. Parts of the Eyre Highway, which links WA to the eastern states, are closed, along with the Trans-Australian Railway line. WA's Department of Fire and Emergency Services say the major freight routes could be closed for up to 5 days. In the north, sections of the Victoria and Great Northern Highways have also been closed due to the floods. While the rain is not good news for the roads, it's been welcomed by pastoralists, with some calling it drought-breaking rain. Tim Carmody runs Prenti Downs Station, about 900 kilometres northeast of Perth. He says it's been raining for a week, and all up, he's received about 140 millimetres of very welcome rain.
It's been just lovely soft rain, no intense falls, and you get a bit of rain, bit of a break, and then just drizzles in between. So it's been cool, very little evaporation. Every bit of rain that's fallen has been available, and it appears to have been all over the station from top to bottom.
Chloe Granger works at Cananda Station along the WA Nullarbor, and she says it's the largest rainfall in more than a decade.
Probably way back to 2011, 2013. So it's been a long time, you know, since a rainfall event like this. I mean, I've only been out this way for give or take about 4 years. So I've certainly seen some bad times, but, you know, for people that have been here for, like, you know, the foresters have been here for 20, 25 years, so massive, like, rainfall event. Like, surely it's drought-breaking. This is it. Like, you know, we're coming out the other end, surely. Like, it's, yeah, it looks awesome.
Vertical farming could be a very viable option for some regions in Australia. Vertical farming is done inside and the crops are grown in stacked layers using artificial growing systems such as hydroponics and generally doesn't use soil. Ron Gerrits has been farming for 30 years and reckons there's big potential for vertical farming in the Northern Territory.
If you grow lettuce in the field, just in the paddock, you can get 4 kilograms per square metre as a production. It will use 500 litres of water to do that. And you can do 2 crop cycles a year. If you do it in the greenhouse, the production goes up to 43 kilograms per square meter. That's 10 times. It uses only 200 litres of water. It's a lot more efficient. In a vertical farm, you can get 120 kilograms per square meter using 1 liter of water. That's the difference.
What's the potential for this in the Northern Territory?
Vertical farming has some problems in the sense that it's expensive to build a vertical farm and quite expensive to run. So they don't make a lot of sense in places where it's easier to grow food in the greenhouse or in the ground and you've got plenty of room. But with climate change and the interruption of our food supply, and so places like Darwin or Alice Springs or remote sites, where the climate is quite extreme as well, perfect places for growing these sort of plants in a vertical farm because there the cost benefit is much higher and so therefore it makes sense to do that.
And there's some celebrations going on in Toowoomba in Queensland after some local school kids smashed the record for Queensland's heaviest pumpkin at the Brisbane Show's Giant Pumpkin Competition. The pumpkin, grown by Year 10 and 11 agricultural science students at Downlands College, weighed in at 368.5 kilos at the show on Saturday. Agricultural teacher Dr. Jeff Buchanan says the kids were thrilled with the title, but they aren't resting on their laurels.
Yep, we blew away their record by nearly 100 kilos. But to give it in context, we've still got a long way to go to the Australian records over 860 and the world records over a ton. So we're still aiming towards that. It's really important to get kids involved in ag, and this is one of the ways we like to get the plant science side of it promoted.
And that wraps up Rural News.
Thanks, Emma. Emma Field there with Rural News. Let's go to the Bureau now. Lincoln Traynor is patiently waiting by. Good afternoon, Lincoln.
Good afternoon, Angus. How are you going?
Well, I'm glad that that heat is finally starting to move on.
Yeah, absolutely. We saw that subtly change gradually move through the south of the state in the early hours today, particularly the southwest was so hot during the weekend, and across the central parts between about 7 and 9 a.m. And then move through Gippsland by lunchtime. It was mainly through the south, this change. The north does not really cool much down during the next few days. We'll start to see it cooling down on Thursday. So we're still keeping an eye on fire dangers up in the north. There's a little bit of wind around. We do see a few patches under severe heat criteria still in Gippsland today because of that late change. So there is a current warning out. It's always good to be aware of the warnings. There's a severe heatwave warning, but it really is the last remnants of that for the Wimmera, East Gippsland, West and South Gippsland, Central, North Central and Southwest districts. But it is important to note that there'll still be some low intensity impacts of heat, particularly across the north until Thursday. So we're not quite out of the woods yet. For today's weather, we will see mild to warm conditions in the south, which is a big welcome change for many people, particularly remaining warm in Gippsland though, around 28 degrees. You might see a bit of a sea breeze around Gippsland still, but it still remains hot in the north. Cloudy across the south with isolated showers south of the divide, as we are now in an unstable southerly flow. Mildura will be 39 today, Shepparton 36, Wangaratta 35, Ballarat 26, Bendigo 33, and Bairnsdale will be 29. If we look at Wednesday, southerlies will persist with mild conditions in the south and isolated showers and remaining a little bit hot in the north above 30 degrees. Mildura will still see 38 degrees, Shepparton 30, Wangaratta 31, Ballarat 21, Bendigo 27, and Bairnsdale finally starting to come down to 23. Thursday, a band of tropical moisture. This is an interesting one because we're looking, is there any rainfall on the horizon? There is a little bit of rainfall on Thursday because we have this tropical moisture from the Pilbara shifting all the way across the continent over us, which could mean some moderate falls across Gippsland, some isolated showers across the state. So we could see 1 to 8 millimetres north of the divide and 5 to 15 millimetres south of the divide. And then conditions shifting back to warm in the north and remaining cool to mild in the south. And there is even a chance of a thunderstorm in the far east of Gippsland in the afternoon. So the temperatures that day, we've then moved from 38 the previous day to 31 now in Mildura. Shepparton will be a cooler 24, Wangaratta 26, Ballarat 20, Bendigo 22 and Bairnsdale 24. Then for Friday, that shower activity contracts to the east and eases in the afternoon for a pretty sunny weekend throughout the state. Conditions remaining warm in the north and mild in the south on Friday. Mildura sitting at about 29, Shepparton the same, 29, Wangaratta also 29, Ballarat 24, Bendigo 27, Bairnsdale 23. And then we are in sunny conditions across the weekend. Winds again begin to move easterly on Saturday, northeasterly on Sunday, and that brings the temperatures to slowly warm up across the state, but nothing like they have been as the high moves into the Tasman. So temperatures will be warm in the north, starting to cross into the low 30s in the north. So, you know, Mildura might see 31. In the south, we'll see mild to warm conditions in the mid to high 20s across Saturday and Sunday. So that's the outlook, Angus.
Okay, Lincoln. So that rain, although probably welcome because it'll be the first rain we've had in a long time, it sounds like it won't be very substantial.
No, not looking super substantial, but you never know. The modelling, it is a bit of a strange phenomena, this tropical moisture. It could unlock a little bit more. So I would say over the coming days, as we get closer, we'll be able to give you accuracy. But right now, it looks like it's not too much of a fall.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on that. Thanks, Lincoln.
No problems, Angus. Thank you.
Lincoln Traynor there, senior forecaster at the Bureau, talking about finally that warm weather that we've had for March dissipating. A little bit of rain on the way as well. And I say warm weather dissipating, I know it is still warm in the northwest. Quick look at the text line. We heard earlier about these pesky little sap-sucking pests that are affecting olives and olive production. Bit of a tongue-in-cheek comment from this texter, they say, was that reference to sap-sucking pests also referring to the tax on utes? Thanks for that text, 0467 842 722 is how you can get in touch on the text line.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, today is the first day of hearings on the parliamentary inquiry into pig welfare in Victoria. It coincides with the release of more secretly filmed footage by animal activism group Farm Transparency Project. That footage, some of which aired on the ABC 7:30 last night, showed cruel, although not illegal, acts against pigs at the Central Victorian piggery Midland Bacon. It also showed a piggery employee allegedly committing an act of bestiality against a pig. The parliamentary inquiry was launched in May last year after that same activist group broke into an abattoir in northeast Victoria and filmed the controversial but legal gas stunning of pigs. Sitting in on that inquiry today is our reporter Beck Simmons, and she joins me now. Afternoon, Beck.
Good morning, Angus. Oh, afternoon.
Afternoon it is now. You've had a busy day, I'm sure.
Yes. I've been listening with very open ears to this inquiry this morning, which has been quite interesting.
Just take us through what's led to this point of having a parliamentary inquiry.
Okay, so last year, around the start of last year, the Farm Transparency Project, which is an animal rights group, made headlines when they broke into a piggery and filmed weeks' worth of footage to show the public and authorities what actually happens when pigs are stunned with CO2 gas prior to being killed. Now, last year, the inquiry was announced. Georgie Purcell, who's the Upper House member for Northern Victoria, she really pushed for that. She's from the Animal Justice Party, and it started this morning. Now, this footage from Midland Bacon's piggery at Stanhope was given to authorities in the last couple of weeks, and it was aired on ABC 7:30 last night. Now, the Farm Transparency Project people, they broke into Midland Bacon at Carrag Carrag near Stanhope, and they installed those secret cameras inside that facility, which filmed about 18 days of vision. And a big thing that they were saying today when they spoke, and I'll go into that into more detail, was that CCTV needs to be going all the time so that people, you know, can go through and see whether these issues or breaches of animal welfare are consistent or if they're one-off mistakes and things like that. So they trawled through all of that footage to record every instance of it.
And Beck, setting aside, as I mentioned, that allegation of bestiality, the other acts captured by the activists, the point was clearly made that as disturbing as they may appear, that they are legal. We're talking here about things like a method of euthanasia of a piglet by essentially smashing its head against the concrete floor. Those things, as disturbing as they may sound, they are actually legal.
Yeah, and I have to admit, So when the Farm Transparency Project spoke this morning, they were the second speaker of the morning, and basically they gave a warning to people that footage might be distressing, both because this is being live streamed, but some people are also in there watching. And look, this might just give you a bit of insight into the dynamics going on within that inquiry committee, because three members actually walked out and refused to watch it.
I'm going to leave the room because I think it's outrageous that we're presenting this material, and I don't want to be here to condone it.
We still have quorum. That's fine.
So that was Bev MacArthur. You probably recognise Bev's voice. But there was also Dr. Renee Heath. She's an Upper House member for Eastern Victoria, and Gail Broad as well. So all Coalition members decided to walk out of that hearing so that they didn't actually see any of that footage or hear any of the noises that were going on as that was being presented.
This is day one of the hearing. Who else, what other groups do we have coming up?
Okay, so today it's all of the animal welfare advocates today, and there's quite a list. So we've also got Edgar's Mission coming up, Animals Australia, Animal Liberation, New South Wales, and Magic Valley, which is an interesting one. And Angus, look, you might have heard of them. Magic Valley is a company which is developing the cultivated meat industry. It's been mentioned over and over that the plant-based food industry might be a direction to go in, as these animal rights advocates are asked repeatedly by MPs whether they think that, you know, they should just can the the pork industry altogether. And they're saying, you know, well, there is this alternative cultivated meat industry. The money could be put into that by the government instead of giving the pork industry all of its funding. So, look, that's been quite interesting, and it'll be interesting to hear Magic Valley talk about its process as well this afternoon. Would you like me to just kind of run through a bit of a explainer as to who Magic Valley is?
Go for it.
Yeah, so basically their submission to this inquiry says that they take a biopsy from a living pig, which continues to live a natural, healthy life thereafter. It's used to cultivate real pork meat in a controlled environment, replicating the taste and texture of conventional pork without the need for slaughter. So they're saying that this might be an answer. But look, overall, a big thing that they want is more regulation. Obviously, they know they're not going to be able to advocate or even with any change made phase out this entire industry overnight or at all. And so they just want footage to be recorded non-stop in piggeries, in abattoirs, all meat processing facilities, so that there's more accountability. I'll just play right now what Harley McDonald-Eckersall from Farm Transparency Project had to say about this.
A lot of these facilities do have CCTV, however, they're mainly used internally, so it's kind of if a worker has an injury or an incident, then they might be reviewed. In the fact that we entered these facilities and installed cameras and weren't caught on camera shows how little they view this footage. I think, as Chris mentioned, unannounced inspections, mandatory inspections as well, and not only just going in, having a look around, giving the thumbs up, but seizing CCTV, reviewing it, examining it.
Yeah, so that's Harley McDonald-Eckersall there from the Farm Transparency Project. So they're basically saying they want the footage. They want that footage to be handed over to both state and federal regulatory bodies whenever they're asked, so that they know that a problem's not systemic, that, you know, say if there is a breach here and there, they can work out whether that's going on all the time or if it's a mistake or, you know, just a discrepancy.
We'll have to leave it there, Beck, but really appreciate you bringing us those details.
Thanks, Angus.
Beck Simmons there, who's been sitting in on that parliamentary inquiry into pig welfare in Victoria and bringing us the details of some of what that committee has heard this morning, including from animal activism groups, including the Farm Transparency Project, which did a break into that piggery in northern Victoria and recorded footage, some of which was played on the ABC's 7:30 last night. This person says the animal activists have admitted breaking into the piggery. Have they been charged for that offence? Can't answer that one. I'm not sure. But you can text in 0467 842 722.
On ABC Radio Victoria, this is the Victorian Country Hour.
Growers across Victoria are being urged to be on the lookout for the invasive pest fall armyworm. Invasive insect species are an increasing threat to agriculture in Australia, and Eastern Australia is among five global regions considered most vulnerable to new invasive species. A 2021 State of the Environment report says the number of invasive species is predicted to increase by 36% by 2050. Fall armyworm is just one of the newly arrived pests, and Agriculture Victoria's plant pests and diseases manager, Chris Piddock, says farmers need to be on the lookout.
Fall armyworm, you would most likely see it as the caterpillar, but it has essentially like a moth stage. There's lots of armyworms that are already part of our grains production landscape that we deal with, but fall armyworm just appears to have a greater ability both to spread but also to do a bit more damage to its favoured crops. It feeds on maize and sweet corn, sorghum and sugarcane, and certainly the experience in Queensland has that it's got a really high preference of feeding on corn. From a Victorian perspective, we do know that we've got some high-value producers of corn and maize and seed crops in Gippsland, but also we're acutely aware a lot of these crops aren't grown in Victoria for seed, they're grown for fodder. It can do damage to those. The way it does its damage is it'll lay masses of eggs underneath the leaves, sort of 100 to 300-ish yellowish little blobs with some sort of hairy bits around it. If they're on the seedling leaves of new crops, when they emerge as little caterpillars, they can pretty much demolish them, and you could really have a failed crop establishment. But later on, it's a bit tricky, because as they grow and they move across the growing plant, they can tend to get into the growing shoot tip, which is called a whorl. They're sort of wrapped up and almost protected. That's where the new yield and that's where the new fodder is growing from. If you were using a chemical, an insecticide, it's also a good protection. They can sort of hide in there.
Fall armyworm first appeared in Africa less than a decade ago, and it's already become established in many parts of the continent, and it's considered a really major threat to food and nutrition security in Africa.
Yes.
And so fall armyworm was first found here in Australia in January 2020, northern Queensland, and it's since spread. The spread that we're seeing in Australia, is it reflective of the speed and aggressiveness with which it's spread in other areas?
Its initial spread in Australia was probably exacerbated by a tropical cyclone that came over the first detection site. But in fact, it can move very effectively under its own power. And so, yes, the ability to contain it and eradicate it is exceedingly low. You would have to find it very, very early and in a landscape that was allowed you to do some pretty broad-scale treatment. So it's very mobile anyway. It wasn't a surprise. It's moved to the other states relatively quickly. I think it was just made even quicker by that weather system. So really, I think once it's across those sort of northern New South Wales and Queensland production zones, I think that's where the majority of its impact will be. But that's not to diminish the fact that if you're growing one of these host crops in Victoria, that it can do some pretty prodigious damage, and that has economic impacts and the like. But we're still finding our way in Australia.
And so you have said that there are a few regions in Victoria that you're particularly concerned about, and you want people to be extra vigilant in those areas. Where are those areas, and do they correlate to the crops that are grown in those regions?
We've had confirmed detections of fall armyworm in East Gippsland through really diligent work by a seed grower in that area, and they work very well with us. And so that's been quite a win-win to be on the front foot for that. We've also had confirmed detections more in the sort of irrigated cropping country south of the Murray in central Victoria, which I equate to people growing irrigated fodder for grazing animals.
That report there from Fiona Broome. Off to markets now, starting today at Ballarat Lambs with Shiona Lamb.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers increased to 27,800 yarded. Quality was mixed with a range from plain to excellent. All the usual buying group attended in a market that opened reasonably firm, but buyers became more selective as prices softened as the sale progressed, with buyers chasing lighter weight categories and neat, short skin, well-finished medium trade weights. Light store and trade lamb sold firm to 5 cheaper, medium trade to 5 softer, heavy trade 5 to 10 cheaper. Heavy export sold to a top of $234 a head, selling 4 to 8 cheaper. Lambs back to the paddock sold 46 to 118, lambs to feed on 120 to $135 a head. Light trade lambs under 18 kilos sold from $75 to $118 a head, trade lambs 18 to 22 kilos sold $115 to $139, and lambs 22 to 26 sold $130 to $166 a head to have a wide range of $5.40 to $6.60 cents a kilo carcass weight. Heavy export lambs 26 to 30 kilos from $156 to $195, and over 30 kilos $192 to $234 a head. There are still 5,800 sheep to be sold. This is Shiona Lamb at Ballarat for MLA.
Thanks, Shiona. Wodonga Cattle now with Leanne Dax.
Good afternoon. In a smaller yarding of 1,030, prices experienced declines following yesterday's markets, with price corrections observed across all categories. Veal in particular saw significant drops ranging from 30 to 70 cents, with the top veal fetching from 220 to 350. Competition from domestic processors for niche trade cattle 400 to 500 kilos was inconsistent, resulting in price declines of 10 to 30 cents. Heifer portions sold from 190 to 240, while steers ranged from 240 to $3. Heavy steers destined for processors saw a decrease of 10 cents, ranging from 234 to 292, while bullocks slipped 15 cents, selling at 240 to 286. Heavy heifers also slipped 20 cents, averaging 219 cents and peaking at 262. In the cow sale, buyers showed interest, but at significantly lower rates. The better cows fetched prices from $2 to $2.35, slipping 32 cents. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. Shep Cattle now with Nicole Varley.
Afternoon. Well, our numbers came back substantially as the opening sales for the week around the state took some heavy price hits. Shepparton was no exception as Asians were faced with some challenges with prices coming back 15 to 40 cents across various grades. There were 850 exports, 275 trade cattle, the exports had 320 cows. Export yarding had several pens of good quality finished steers and beef cows. Dairy cow numbers came back. Trade cattle were of mixed quality. A large proportion of plain quality store conditioned cattle were about. Prices were wide ranging. Butchers and processors searched for the better lines and bidded competitively for the top calves and yearlings with weight. There was a handful of supplementary fed yearlings. The heavy veelers made to 378. Yearling steers to the trade 268 to 330. Yearling heifers 230 to 340 cents. 400 to 500 kilo steers 223 to 275. 5 to 600 to 288. 600 kilo plus bullocks, $2.42 to $3. Cows met price falls of 15 to 28 cents a kilo.